From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Sounds from London as President Trump opened a state visit to the UK today amid pomp, circumstance, and controversy. He got a warm welcome from the Queen and the Prince of Wales at Buckingham Palace just a few hours after calling the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, a stone-cold loser in a tweet. Khan had criticized the president in a newspaper column, saying he represents the far right's threat to liberal democracy. Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, a lot of people are wondering why this state visit is even happening right now for a number of reasons. But given what we just said about how the president started the visit, can you answer that question?
It's a very good question. I guess it's as the UK tries to sort of separate out the difficulty of dealing with President Trump and its relationship with the United States. And of course, one of the things about Brexit, whether you like it or not, it does involve the UK having to just of necessity pivot away from Brussels to Washington. Now, for an awful lot of Brits, that is immensely uncomfortable given the current incumbent of the White House. But the sort of view across the sort of political spectrum, I mean, not entirely, but broadly, that the view is, look, you just have to grin and bear it. And for the sake of the UK's immensely important relationship with the US, the president must be treated as an honored guest.
Well, and I've been listening to some interviews that some British politicians have been doing, and that's what they're focused on is, look, we this relationship is much bigger than any one person. And, you know, no matter what, we have this very important relationship. But is he testing that special relationship with what he's been saying?
Well, he's certainly getting politicians to perform contortions. I mean, I've heard the same things. I mean, you can imagine what it goes like. British media will read the sort of tweets that the president has tweeted, such as the one about Sadiq Khan, saying, hang on a minute, is this really acceptable? Should you be hosting someone like this? And we get all these kind of dreadful contortions by British politicians, particularly those in the government, sort of, yes, well, you know, I mean, of course, yes, what we want from the, you know, it's all about the United States, our great ally. So a lot of people listening will just find that incredibly uncomfortable and wonder why on earth British politicians can't say, actually, we find this particular incumbent of the White House somewhat distasteful by our British tastes. But, you know, obviously we still love the U.S. Well, but they don't do that, and they tie themselves in knots.
Except for Sadiq Khan, who did do that, and look what happened. Now, what about Theresa May? Because this is her final days as prime minister. Are there going to be any substantive meetings between the president and the prime minister?
To describe Theresa May as the lamest of lame ducks is somewhat cruel to lame ducks. I mean, I don't mean that in a really sort of nasty way. I didn't mean to be mean-spirited, but as you point out, I mean, she will be gone as leader of the Conservative Party on June the 7th, I think it is. Mm-hmm. But she'll be staying on as Prime Minister until the Conservative Party can replace her. So, look, she is a lame duck. There's no two ways. I would say that expectations for the sort of political gains from the meeting between the president and the prime minister are from low to zero. I mean, who really expects the president to strike any particular agreement or deals with a prime minister who's soon to be gone and a government that's going to be under very different leadership, or at least different leadership?
Well, the president is sort of dangling this idea of a US-UK trade deal. Do people take that seriously? Do they think that, you know, if they do what he's suggesting, which is to just crash out of the European Union, that they're going to have a trade deal with the US on the other side?
Guess what, Jeremy? It just splits. It's entirely divisive and splits along the lines you would expect. So people who are on the Remain side of the debate think that that is absolutely nuts. I mean, that the president's intervention in Brexit is totally nuts. And they would point to the government's own internal figures, which suggest that at any free trade deal with the US, the most it would do is to boost UK GDP by 0.3%. But of course, there are lots of people who are on the sort of hard Brexit wing of the Conservative Party, and some of the people who voted Leave say, yeah, bring it on, let's stick it to those Europeans. So he's immensely divisive along those lines. But here's the really strange thing if you step back from this. If you think about it, it's worth remembering that from the Second World War onwards, I mean, this is how abnormal the times we're living in. It had been the goal of every US president, Republican and Democrat alike, to have a strong, united Europe through NATO, through the European Union, and with, guess what, its prime ally in Europe, the UK right at the heart of it. And now we have a president not only encouraging Brexit, thinking it's a good idea, describing the EU as rivals, but actually urging the UK to sue Brussels. And that just gives you a sense of the sort of strange times that we're living in.
Well, President Trump has also been praising Boris Johnson, who's seen as the front runner to be the next prime minister. Does that help Boris Johnson to have the praise of somebody like President Trump, who's not all that popular in the UK?
Well, you know, it helps Boris Johnson with the kind of people that like Donald Trump, right? And because Boris Johnson's efforts to succeed Theresa May, I mean, he's not opening himself up to all 45 million of us eligible voters. It's just the 120,000 or so members of the governing Conservative Party. So, yeah, and an awful lot of them are more sympathetic to Donald Trump than the rest of the general population, which is not very sympathetic at all. And while we're on that subject, you know, one of my colleagues at the BBC, he did a film about the visits of past presidents to the UK from the Second World War onwards. And it was really striking. I mean, the kind of crowds that turned out for Kennedy, for Eisenhower, for Ronald Reagan, even for Jimmy Carter, it's really striking when you now think, what's the situation we're in, that maybe as many as 400,000, who knows, are expected to demonstrate against the president tomorrow.
Wow. Do you have your ticket to the state dinner tonight?
Dashed. I'm looking everywhere in my pockets, Jeremy. They seem to have left me out.
Okay.
There might be some vacancies because, as you know, some British politicians are boycotting it. So maybe it's not too late for me to call the palace.
Maybe
Your Majesty.
They'll use the smaller room at the palace, I guess, for the dinner. That is BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, back at home, the California State Senate passed a bill last week aiming to significantly reduce single-use plastic packaging like water bottles. A similar bill passed the State Assembly. Both bills call for manufacturers to reduce plastic waste by 75% by 2030. And some entertainment venues in San Francisco are stepping up to do their part. In this chapter of our ongoing series, Going to Waste, Chloe Veltman of member station KQED reports.
At the Cavernous Recology Recycling Plant on San Francisco's waterfront, company spokesman Robert Reed and I watch mesmerized as a hailstorm of plastic bottles pelts down from the rafters into a giant metal cage below our feet.
I mean, there's just dozens of them falling down every few seconds. Give you a sense of how fast they get consumed in San Francisco.
Reed says recent research shows people use 500 billion plastic bottles a year. They're a huge environmental hazard. And Reed says the market for them isn't what it used to be, now that China, which used to recycle about half of the world's plastic, has slashed imports.
When China said no more, it left countries and cities scrambling to figure out what they're going to do with all their plastics.
The Recology plant also processes aluminum cans, which are easier and more profitable to recycle than other beverage containers.
And there's a worldwide market for aluminum cans. Very limited markets for the plastic.
So it's no wonder that ecologically minded entertainment venues in the Bay Area are starting to see aluminum as a possible alternative to the thousands of plastic containers they throw out every time they have an event.
We started to look at the numbers and they were staggering. Around 25,000 water bottles just on New Year's Eve alone.
Kelsey Issel is the art director at the Midway. The music venue and gallery space in San Francisco's Dogpatch neighborhood allows people to bring in and refill their own water bottles. And in January, it switched from selling water in single-use plastic bottles to resealable aluminum.
Instead of buying four water bottles in a night, they can buy one aluminum water bottle and refill it throughout the night.
Issel says since ditching plastic, the Midway has cut its water bottle consumption by two-thirds.
We're really noticing the dramatic reduction in waste.
The Fillmore in San Francisco made a similar switch in May. General Manager Amy Bailey Nobler is happy about the change to aluminum cans, but she says hard metal surfaces can be a safety hazard at some events.
Bands, they don't want canteens or stuff like that in a crowd if there's a mosh pit kind of situation or something.
Another issue is cost. Nobler says the cans are more than four times the price of plastic bottles. A venue like the Fillmore, owned by the entertainment corporation Live Nation, is more likely to be able to absorb the expense than a small indie player like the Midway.
It's a significant loss, yeah.
Kelsey Issel says her company is willing to take the hit because of its commitment to reducing waste. She hopes profit margins will improve as more eco-friendly manufacturers enter the market to meet consumer demand.
We don't want to see this in the environment any more than anyone else.
Scott DeFife of the Plastics Industry Association says the group applauds these efforts to reduce unnecessary waste. But he says we need more efficient systems to process the debris concertgoers leave behind.
If you're going to have that many people using disposable packaging, you're going to need additional waste management infrastructure to capture all of the material.
Over at the Recology Recycling Plant, Robert Reed says what's most important right now is reducing our waste footprint overall.
Do simple things so we don't make so much garbage.
Like bringing your own bottle the next time you go hear live music. And the next. And the next. For Here and Now, I'm Chloe Veltman in San Francisco.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, control your comfort.
Tom grew up in a working-class neighborhood outside London and described his fascination with theoretical astrophysics, with black holes and how they must be linked through the space-time continuum to white holes, when he was 5. He's now 11. His greatest pleasure is taking math tests designed for graduating high schoolers. So begins a fascinating article about gifted children in The Economist's 1843 magazine. We're not talking about kids pressured by aggressive, privileged parents, but children who often push their parents to the brink because of what the article calls the curse of genius. It's a small group, less than 1% of the population by most accounts, who perform so outside the norm that they have neither a peer group nor a system to facilitate their learning. Writer Maggie Ferguson tells their story. She joins us from The Economist studios in London. Maggie, welcome.
Thank you.
And also joining us is Chrissy, the mother of Tom, who we just described. Chrissy, welcome to you as well.
Hello, thank you.
And I want to start with you because I want to make sure I've characterized this correctly. You know, I think a lot of parents hearing about a 5-year-old talking about, astrophysics would think, oh, wouldn't that be great? They can't get their 19-year-old to care about science. But you say what?
It's hard. It's hard to keep up.
Yeah.
Really, really, really hard.
Well, in fact, you told Maggie, I can't cope with it. I just want to take it away. I mean, of course you adore Tom,
I just want him to be happy. And there are moments he is happy sometimes. There are things that really make him happy. But in general, it's hard. I don't know why you would want this for your child.
Yeah, because he has some severe depression.
Yeah, he had depression when he was 5, 6, and he kind of came out of it. And at the minute, he has got existential depression, which is slightly more worrying about the world and why we're here and existence, and there's no answer. And it's just managing and trying to distract him from things like that.
Yeah.
He's a really good working adult's brain in a child.
It might be worth my saying, this is Maggie coming in now, that when I started off on this article, there was no preconceived angle. So I didn't begin work thinking that I wanted to find kids and parents who were being made very unhappy by being gifted. I had imagined I would find exactly the opposite. But as it turned out, most of the people I spoke to were finding it very hard indeed dealing with high levels of giftedness.
Well, Maggie Ferguson, tell us a little more about that. Chrissy just said, so profound, an adult brain and a child's body. Talk about the impact of that, Maggie.
Well, what I did fairly early on in my research was to get in touch with Mensa, which is the organization in this country, and I know it's in America as well, for very gifted people, not just children. And they put out an email asking for parents and children who would be prepared to speak to me. And I was absolutely deluged with emails and calls from mothers who spoke to me almost with a sense of shame. It's as if they were telling me some sort of dark secret, because having a gifted child is not something that most parents feel able to talk about.
Let me jump in there to underscore that. You talked to a parent who said when other children come over to play, she has to hide the toys and books of her child because it'll give away that the child is so advanced, and they so desperately want the child to be able to have a normal, you know, interaction.
That was a mother who lives in Cornwall, speaking about her daughter. Her little girl is extraordinarily, terrifyingly bright, and she told me a story of how, aged 18 months only, this little girl was in the bath one night and her mother forgot to bring her face cloth to the bath. And this little 18-month-old girl said to her, "Mummy, you're an abomination." Well, this mother went on to say that she now hides the child's toys when other children come around to play because she's so embarrassed that this little girl is so far ahead. And that seemed to be quite typical.
Yeah, well, Chrissy, talk more about, you know, there may be embarrassment. You talk about, you know, your son having these very dark thoughts.
Yeah, he sees the bigger picture. So for him, it's almost like he just seems to sort of second guess everything. And he analyzes. He can't get on with just being a child and just play.
Maggie Ferguson, you found this from others who had studied children who were gifted. They are driven. They have a rage to master.
It's a wonderful phrase. And that does seem to be a kind of identifying feature of very gifted children. But the kind of high achieving element that Chrissy is talking about can also go hand in hand with what's called asynchronous development, so that although a child's brain is developing very fast in terms of numbers, words, patterns, the frontal lobes, which govern how we develop in our relationships with other people, do not develop as fast in these children. And therefore, friendship can be very difficult and loneliness is a problem.
They have trouble sleeping. They can have physiological conditions like food allergies, asthma, which go hand in hand with this sensory processing disorder. And Chrissy, we understand that, you know, obviously a gifted child might be the target of other kids. So tough. But also the target of adults. One teacher in Tom's case.
Yeah, when he was in his infant school, there was a couple of times where he'd come out and in front of all the parents, she patted him on the head and said, "Toby really struggled with his maths today." And she was giving him maths that you'd give to a sort of 15, 16-year-old. And he was 6 at the time. And funnily enough, he loved it and he could do it. But yes, he wasn't getting everything right. There was real bitterness. He could see through it. He could see the bitterness.
Yeah.
I just don't understand why, as a teacher, you wouldn't relish a child that just wants to learn.
Yeah. Talk more about what do we do in school, Maggie, for these kids, a very small number. In some cases, they're forced to slow down, to stay with the class they're in. It's torture for some of these kids. And you also say that what happens with many of these gifted kids, they're called lost Einsteins. They don't fulfill their promise. So what's the solution for these children?
Well, the solution is to have some kind of special provision for gifted children. There's a psychotherapist called Sonia Falk who specializes in looking after people with extreme intelligence. And I think she was right when she says it's a real suffering, that boredom is really dangerous. I was told about a boy who'd been at Eton College, you know, one of the best schools in this country. He was extremely clever. He wrote a short poem for the school magazine, which simply ran, "If I should die, think only this of me, ennui." And he committed suicide.
Mm.
That was an extreme example.
Ennui, E-N-N-U-I, just boredom and nothingness, ennui.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's Chrissy. I'm sorry that you have to hear this because I know you're struggling, you know, with Tom. And
he talked about when he was about 5, he said to me that he felt like he didn't want to be here. And he just said, I'd repeatedly sort of bash my head against the wall until it's over. And then, you know, he worked on it and it kind of went, you know, the depression did go. But then it just come back, and it's come back recently. It's horrendous. And the trouble is that there are a lot of people that don't take it seriously because they just think they're a child. So what are they miserable about?
Well, the article ends with an incredibly poignant note. You are talking to Maggie about what we call these lost Einsteins. And in fact, Einstein was almost a lost Einstein. You know, he had written, I'm known so universally and yet I'm so lonely. And you turned to Maggie and said, show me one child like this whose life ends up well, they don't exist. And Tom is sitting right there, you know, and you turned to him. What did you say to him?
He can be the first. Why not? I just want him to be happy. That's all. And I don't know what the answer is. I mean, it's hard because kids that struggle, they are a priority. They're all a priority. It's just, I understand the struggle with schools. I get why they have it. I just wish that these children were identified.
Although, sorry, it's Maggie coming in again. Even if they're identified at school, it's not absolutely clear what is the best thing to be done for them. Some parents opt for homeschooling. So that they can take children at their own pace. But then there's all the problems about the development of their social lives and making friends. That's very difficult if you're being homeschooled. Or you can be pushed out of your year group. You can be accelerated up so that you're learning with children 3-4 years older. But again, that has implications in the development of your social life. So it's not quite clear what you do even once they've been identified.
Well, Chrissy, we wish you all the best, and you know, I'm thinking
Thank
that.
You.
Well, I'm thinking that maybe what you are doing for Tom right now, in recognizing him and, you know, letting him participate and, you know, figuring out his own story, maybe that will be the thing that, you know, gives him some purpose there.
Yeah, I think watching young Sheldon's really helped.
What'd you say?
And the Big Bang Theory. I said he watches young Sheldon in the Big Bang Theory. That's actually really helped.
Yes.
Because I think he realises that when he's older, he will have a group of friends that get him, which is great. You know, yeah. I think he can kind of like see that it will happen. It's just he's got a little bit of time to wait.
One more reason to love the Big Bang Theory and Sheldon.
Yeah.
That's Chrissy here now. 11-year-old son Tom is one of the children profiled by Maggie Ferguson in her terrific article, The Curse of Genius. Maggie, thank you also for your writing. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chicago's new mayor, Lori Lightfoot, is asking the city's longest-serving alderman to step down after a 14-count federal indictment charged him with racketeering, attempted extortion, and bribery. Prosecutors say Ed Burke used his powerful position in city government to enrich himself. For more, we're joined now by WBEZ's city politics reporter Claudia Morell in Chicago. Hi, Claudia.
Hi.
And what are prosecutors alleging that Burke did exactly?
So this is a sweeping indictment where they have alleged that Burke tried to steer business to his private law firm, and he has, it's 14 counts in total, 19, and this adds on to previous alleged extortion charges that he tried to shake down a Burger King franchise in his district for a driveway permit.
And what has his response been to all of this?
The alderman hasn't spoken on the record yet since the latest indictment came down on Thursday, but his attorneys have said that the alderman is innocent and that he will be vindicated.
And the interesting thing is that amidst all of this, and when we were in Chicago earlier this year, we were talking about Ed Burke, and then he got reelected after all of these allegations had come out. The indictment hadn't come down yet, but the allegations had, and he was reelected in February. He's still a very powerful person, though, in Chicago.
Yes, he doesn't wield as much power as he used to at City Hall. One aspect of his position at City Hall was a finance chair, which he had to step down after the federal criminal complaint in January. But that perch gave him a lot of power because as finance chair, he determined where all the city dollars went to for like city subsidies. If someone wanted to do a major development and wanted some taxpayer dollars to help out, you know, Burke would be the committee that you would go through. All new taxes went through his office, all property tax increases. And so he, according to this complaint, kind of used that position to then say, well, if you want to get on the agenda, and they have this on tape recording, if you want to get this on the agenda, then you need to bring business to my private firm.
We mentioned that Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot, the new mayor there, has called on Burke to step down. Let's listen to a little bit of what she told reporters on Friday.
No one can serve with integrity and legitimacy and deliver on behalf of their constituents with this kind of allegation hanging over them. And so for these reasons, I'm calling on him to resign.
How significant is that, that the new mayor of Chicago, inaugurated just 2 weeks ago, elected on an anti-corruption platform, comes out so soon and says what she said?
You know, it is really significant that she said that because before she was elected and before she was a private attorney, she was a federal prosecutor. And one of the cases that she took part in was Silver Shovel back in the 1990s, where it was the largest takedown of city council corruption. And so from having that background and saying that after reading this superseding indictment that came down on Thursday, that she was really troubled by all of the allegations, saying that, you know, this wasn't just, you know, taking money at a coffee shop, a one-time payout. This, she said, it shows a pattern of widespread corruption, and said that, you know, as a public official, you need to be held at a higher standard, and therefore he should step down.
That's Claudia Morell, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. Claudia, thanks.
Thank you.
The Trump administration has until the end of the week to respond to a court filing from last week questioning the administration's motives in adding that controversial "Are you a citizen?" question to the 2020 census. The administration says it's adding the question to better enforce the Voting Rights Act. But newly revealed documents show the question was added as a way to help white Republicans redraw political maps and solidify power at the expense of brown residents. And this lower court questioning is happening as the case is being considered by the Supreme Court. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang has been covering this. He joins us now. Hansi, hi.
Hi, Robin.
This is an incredible story. Republican gerrymandering expert Thomas Hoffler died last year. And after that, his estranged daughter found these hard drives related to his work, including his writing after Hoffler was asked by a conservative news outlet to look into what would happen if political maps were drawn only based on American citizens, you know, people of voting age. What did he conclude?
He concluded that if you were to add a citizenship question onto census forms, you would have the necessary information in order to redraw political maps that he said would be advantageous to Republicans and non-Hispanic white people. And we know that because these hard drives were discovered by his estranged daughter, who happened to then get connected with lawyers that a law firm that was representing two separate cases, one about a North Carolina gerrymandering case at a North Carolina state court. A legal firm involved with that was also involved with one of the citizenship question lawsuits here in New York. And because of that connection, that's how plaintiffs in one of the citizenship question lawsuits are citing these documents, they say, as evidence that Thomas Hoffler played a very big role, they say, in shaping this question that this administration wants to add to the 2020 census.
Well, in fact, he wrote a memo that helped make the administration's case for doing this as, you know, supporting the Voting Rights Act. And the members of the administration, you know, went before that lower court and said that it was for the Voting Rights Act. But these documents seem to show that it wasn't. It was to benefit Republicans and other non-Hispanic Americans.
Well, the connection the plaintiffs in the citizenship question lawsuits are arguing, these are plaintiffs represented by the ACLU as well as law firm Ardell & Porter, they're arguing that among the documents found in Hoffler's files is a paragraph that explains how that would essentially justify adding a citizenship question to better enforce part of the Voting Rights Act and better protect the voting rights of minorities, including Latino folks. And this paragraph that they found in Hoffler's files matches word for word with a paragraph found in an early draft of a request that the Justice Department apparently was preparing to submit to the Census Bureau to formally request a citizenship question. And this draft of a letter, a Justice Department official said that that was an early draft that he looked over before he helped to ghostwrite later on the official draft. And these developments in Hoffler's role regarding the writing here and these memos were not disclosed in the depositions given before the trial happened here in New York for the citizenship question lawsuits. And so the plaintiffs here are arguing that Trump administration official and Justice Department, as well as a consultant advisor to Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who oversees the Census Bureau, that these two folks, that they may have misrepresented what actually happened during the deposition.
So they're appealing to the lower court that made the first ruling. But what does this mean for the Supreme Court that's actually considering the question, you know, considering the lower court's ruling and the question of having the census question?
That's a really good question, and we're going to have to see what happens, I think, first at the lower court at the hearing on Wednesday to see what this lower court says about these new documents, whether it considers it evidence that's sanctionable, mm-hmm. And also then to see how this could possibly affect how the Supreme Court is ruling. They're expected to rule by the end of the month, and again, the deadline is very, very close. The printing of the 2020 census form, the Census Bureau says, has to start by July 1st in order to meet the current budget allocations.
Wow, what an incredible story, all because an strange daughter came home after her father died. Just something. NPR's Hansi-Lu Wang, thank you so much. We'll follow this.
You're welcome.
But now we turn to immigration. Along the Texas border with Mexico, there's a special zone that stretches 100 miles into Texas. There, U.S. immigration officials have more powers and can use what's called expedited removal to deport someone without appeal. Expedited removal is becoming increasingly common, and though it speeds up processing times, critics say it can lead to wrongful detention and deportation. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval reports.
Last December, Elvin was on a bus back home to Houston after looking for welding work in Laredo. Then immigration officials stopped him at a Border Patrol checkpoint. They questioned and detained him for 5 days.
I didn't know nothing about him 5 days later.
That's his wife, Isabel, a DACA recipient. We're not using their last name because of immigration concerns. At the time, she was 2 months pregnant with their third child, all U.S. citizens. Elvin grew up in Honduras, but has lived in the U.S. for 12 years without papers. His dad's a citizen, so he has an immigration petition in process. But according to government documents, Customs and Border Protection officers believed he had recently entered the U.S., even though Elvin says he told them he's been here since 2007.
Yo nunca he sido deportado. Yo he estado viviendo en este país desde el 2007.
Despite his pleas, the federal agents used the expedited deportation process. We contacted Customs and Border Protection for comment, and they have not responded. Elvin was moved to detention centers in San Antonio, then Wisconsin, then Illinois. Isabel drained their savings on lawyer fees only to have a judge order Elvin deported to Honduras.
I had to go to the court. I had to look for papers. Sometimes I was throwing up. I feel dizzy and I still have to drive.
She was on her own, pregnant and raising their two kids, kids who missed their dad.
When my son woke up in the morning, he was asking, Mami, papi no me dio besito. He was saying, daddy didn't give me a kiss. What is daddy? Because he didn't give me a kiss. And that breaks my heart.
I cried day and night, Elvin says. Locked away in a tiny cell in an Illinois county jail, his mind was racing.
¿Y ahora qué voy a hacer? Me van a mandar a mi país. Y mis hijos van a quedar aquí. ¿Quién nos va a ayudar?
What am I going to do? He asked himself. They're going to send me back to my country while my kids stay here, he says. Who's going to help them? Isabel turned to her family in Tucson. With no income and now no savings, they had to quickly move away from their home in Houston. They thought all was lost. Then some lawyers from the Chicago-based National Immigrant Justice Center stepped in. Days before his flight to Honduras, they showed a federal judge proof Elvin has been living here. His marriage certificate, tax returns, a credit card statement. In a rare move, the judge canceled his deportation. Elvin was released and sent to Arizona.
I was really, really happy that I screamed.
But not everyone who gets picked up at the border has the same happy ending. The procedure used to try to deport Elvin, an expedited removal, was used to deport over 103,000 migrants in 2017, according to Department of Homeland Security data. Expedited removal speeds up the processing of migrants found within the 100-mile border zone who have entered the country within 14 days. Julie Posh is an attorney who defends detained immigrants for the Houston Immigration Legal Services Collaborative. She's never seen anybody with his background put in expedited removal proceedings, but she's also not convinced he's the only one.
What's concerning me is that if this is happening to him, how many other people is it happening to who didn't have access to an attorney or didn't have the ability to push back?
Posh says what is common about Elvin's case is the incorrect documents.
Finding either outright falsifications or errors, and oftentimes it's difficult to tell which, on documents prepared by Customs and Border Protection is extremely common.
She says she's seen a large share of clients with inaccurate paperwork. Clients have shown her documents saying they came to the U.S. to work when the client says they actually left their countries out of fear for their safety. Posh says that inaccuracy can make all the difference in asylum proceedings since our laws protect people fleeing violence, not economic strife. For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Trovall.
The intelligence community, looking ahead to the 2020 election and possible interference, is trying to anticipate meddling that could look very different than it did in 2016. They're worried in part about deep fakes, videos made from a single image. And Samsung just announced that its artificial intelligence lab in Russia can now make deep fakes. For more, let's bring in Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
Okay, well, let's first explain what we're talking about here. These are videos that appear to make the image, the people in them, say something that they never actually said. There's one that I've seen of the Mona Lisa talking.
Yes.
How does this work?
Okay, so quick and dirty explanation of machine learning, which is involved in this, right? So that's training algorithms, but with like butt-ton loads of data, if I can say that on the radio,
yeah.
So that the algorithm can reorganize or recreate that data. And what is interesting about this is that the deepfake technology originally created for this is becoming more and more readily available and usable to people who don't even really need to be technically savvy. You can kind of plug in video footage, train up the algorithm, and then tell it what to do with the information.
And if you were to ask Samsung, why are you doing this?
Why?
They would say what?
So the researchers involved in this particular experiment, this particular study and paper that came out of it, say that there are potential applications for video games, film, and television. Now, the idea for video games here is that potentially your avatar in a video game could be trained to exist in a game and move around with just a selfie of you that you give the game when you're building your character, right? Mm. Something similar could happen even with teleconferencing. In an interesting way, there's a potential business application there.
I can have my avatar just sit in on a meeting for me.
Exactly.
Just take care of this, please.
And no one knows you're asleep.
Nobody
exactly.
Knows, right?
Yeah. And of course, I'm less of a TV or movie expert here, but if you think about Star Wars and how those movies treated Princess Leia after Carrie Fisher had died, that's a potential application for this as well.
Okay, but there's a lot of possibility for nefarious purposes for this technology. We just saw the altered videos of Nancy Pelosi that went viral last week that made it look like she was, you know, having trouble speaking or slowing down her speech.
Yeah, absolutely. And you saw Facebook reacting to that by trying to surface information like the original not slowed down video next to the slowed down one. The accessibility of the technology is, I think, a real concern. And we should mention that it first really surfaced on Reddit, thanks to a user who built the technology and put it on that site. And they used it to put celebrities' faces onto pornographic videos that didn't actually involve those celebrities. So this was a big story in 2018. Obviously, there's a concern about so-called revenge porn there, using people's identity without their permission in a whole host of ways. But there are bigger sort of political implications as well, right?
Well, and let's talk about that, because the word deep fakes, which most people probably haven't heard of, is something that actually I have now heard the director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, use in a congressional hearing. They're worried about this. Here's Senator Angus King, independent from Maine, in a hearing last September questioning Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg about them because there's concern that this could be the next phase of disinformation in 2020.
Is there a technological way that you can determine that a video has been manipulated in that way and tag it?
And Sandberg had not a very satisfactory response. She said Facebook would continue to invest in technology and people. But that is a big question. What about that? Is there a way to determine whether something is fake or real?
So as per usual, this game of cat and mouse, Jeremy, will continue forever, probably. It is super interesting to see how the game plays out. There's a professor at Dartmouth. He's now at UC Berkeley, Hani Farid, who is sort of fighting fire with fire here, training algorithms on already available data of political figures to recognize personal, specific patterns of what their faces do while talking about different topics to catch fakes by pointing out that they just don't match up with what that person would normally do. There's also a computer science professor named Swa Yu who noticed that in deepfake videos, the faked faces of people don't blink enough. So he's working on using that to identify fakes as well. Also, DARPA is getting involved. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency has solicited solutions on this from experts. So there are absolutely tools being built to identify fakes, but it is this kind of continuing cat and mouse game.
Well, and also, even if you come out and identify a fake after it's already had its desired impact, let's say in an election, it may be too late at that point.
That's absolutely right. And I think with all of these things, it's often not the technology necessarily that gets built. It's what we do with it. So, yes, of course, people are going to do nefarious things with this stuff. And I think one big question is, at least in terms of trying to counter this and counter misinformation, is how are the big tech companies going to deal with this content on their platforms? What are they going to do to make sure that this stuff doesn't actually get surfaced for people in the first place? And that's a really, really, really hard nut to crack.
Well, and they don't have a great track record, by the way, as of yet, on dealing with some of these big questions we've been asking now for some time. Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
New technology. Scary new technology.
You show me the pictures. It's incredible.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.